Good evening. So, the beginning of this month, which seems like a long time ago now, I led the half-day sitting, and in that talk, I discussed the etymology or the derived meaning of the word shikantaza. And this is the word that I'm not going to repeat all that discussion that I gave at the sitting, but we colloquially translate that word as just sitting. The practice of sitting meditation, not for any gain or any betterment of ourselves, but simply for the sake, to sit for the sake of the sitting itself. Sit the meditation for the sake of the meditation. This is like art, you know. People used to criticize, is this art for art's sake? And we say, in this tradition, say, yes, this is meditation for the sake of meditation. It has no other purpose. It's a meditation to celebrate the meditation. And so, you know, when I go out, when I talk to people who aren't members of this Sangha or another Sangha or familiar with the path of one who practices, and they ask me what I do, I don't say I practice shikantaza. I practice meditation. And if they ask me what I was doing, sometimes they ask me, well, what are you doing this weekend? And I say, well, I'm going to a meditation retreat. Or I say, I'm leading a meditation retreat. So, you know, meditation is the word of common currency in our culture. So when we talk to people outside of this room, outside of this Dharma Center, that's usually what we say. And the Sanskrit word for meditation is jhana. Jhana. And it's used to describe the various techniques and intentions that we bring to our sitting cushion. So when we, for instance, give meditation instruction, we talk about, you know, we start people off kind of slowly, right? We don't, you know, we pretend that there's something to do. And so we talk about, you know, posture, and we talk about breath, and we talk about, you know, keeping the eyes open and cast down at a 45 degree angle and so forth. We give some concrete body-based instructions about how to do meditation. And I think this has been this kind of approach by people that meditate, meeting lay people who want to learn to meditate, has been going on for quite a while. And so they've had this word, this dhyana word, goes back to ancient India. And that word got translated into Chinese as chan. And then it got translated into Japanese as zen. And so these, in all those cultures, each of those cultures, this word for meditation is the word of common currency. It's the word of common usage to describe and include the culture to help clue the culture in what we're, you know, what this practice is. It's sort of a baseline word. But of course, when we come into this hall, we find out that there are other words that can be used for our practice. And whereas shikantaza is one of those words, and it's a favored word of this particular school that we sit in with as an inheritor of, the Soto Zen school is particularly fond of this word shikantaza, which might be not obviously, but it comes from Japanese. It's a Japanese derivation. But we have other words. There's other words that go back a little farther before shikantaza was a word. Japan didn't have even a written language until like 600. It was a backward country. So they probably didn't have a word for shikantaza. They didn't have the word. They didn't have a character. They didn't have characters for it. And when they didn't even have characters for it, there were already other people in other parts of the world, particularly in India, that had developed multiple words for this sitting practice. And one of those words that they developed was samadhi, the word samadhi. And it comes from Sanskrit. So I want to talk tonight a little bit about samadhi, which appears in when we read ancient sutras, when we read the purported, word of the Buddha, we're going to read the word or see the characters for, or see the, we wouldn't probably recognize the Sanskrit characters for samadhi, but anyway, that would be the word that we would be reading, that would be describing this meditation. And I think that samadhi is a word that is close, actually, in meaning and flavor and intent as shikantaza. And what I would say about it is that how we might characterize samadhi or shikantaza particularly is that those techniques and instructions and the intention that we teach people and talk to people about this meditation with somewhat fade into the background. They're still there. Those things are still there. Those instructions, pointers are still there, but in samadhi and I would say shikantaza, they've been incorporated. They've been incorporated. So it's like you learned how to shoot a basketball. So you can shoot a basketball without further instruction, and you naturally can shoot the basketball. So samadhi has a sense of, well, the techniques and the coaching and the so forth falling more into the background, and the actual intent or direction and flavor of sitting comes more to the foreground of consciousness. So I have been sitting with this for a few days, and this idea of how to talk about samadhi, and One way is that is again very similar to Shikantaza. Instead of there being an agent, a person doing the meditation, we could say that the meditation is doing the meditation. We could say that the meditation is doing, and the doer of the meditation has dropped a little off into the background. So the meditation is in the foreground of this characterization, this word, this practice, if it can even be called that. Elsewhere it's called other things. So, elsewhere, as I'll talk about, actually, it's called a mystical transformation. It's called a mystical transformation. So we have this meditation, this sitting meditation, and it has techniques and things to do. And at some point, it also transforms. It has a transformative character that comes to the fore. You could say the meditation is doing the meditation, or you could also say a Buddha is doing the meditation, or Buddha is in charge of the meditation, or that the samadhi is Buddha's compassionate response. The samadhi is the Buddha's compassionate response to our effort, to the attention, the intention, and the technique that we practice. The Buddha comes to us. If we have this, if we have a kind of religious frame of mind, in any case, we could imagine the Buddha as compassionately responding to the effort we're making. So sometimes I call samadhi, if it appears, if samadhi seems to arise, I sometimes put words on it. Maybe because I have to give a Dharma talk. So sometimes I say it's granular, moment-by-moment awareness. Granular, moment-by-moment awareness. And sometimes I just call it composed. Composed. Sometimes I call it, and think of it, as a great healing power. I feel its healing energy suffusing me as a great healing power. And sometimes I think this samadhi is realization. This very samadhi is realization. Which is kind of the conclusion that Dogen came to. This very practice is realization. So we chanted tonight the song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, and it says, it said, it told us that samadhi arises when erroneous imaginations cease. When erroneous imaginations cease, the acquiescent mind, the mind that gives in, that surrenders to the meditation, the acquiescent mind realizes itself when erroneous imaginations cease. Dogen says that samadhi happens in stillness. And he describes it as when mind and object merge. When mind and object merge. And he says they merge and go beyond enlightenment. And this is a pretty standard, actually, definition of samadhi is the breaking down of a barrier between self and other, mind and object, breaking down of that duality is samadhi. And Suzuki Roshi had a name for it, a different name for it, samadhi. He called it naturalness. It's a hard word to say. I misled you with my gobbling it. Naturalness. And he said it's when our mind is, that's an important part, is perfect freedom. When our mind is perfect freedom, and when our mind is open to everything. And then he brings up the mirror. He says, open to everything, the way a mirror is open to everything that comes before it. So when our mind is perfect freedom, freedom from what? Freedom from all phenomena, freedom from all arisings, freedom from thought. And Maizumi Rishi said, samadhi, this is a gentler definition, a more maybe accessible definition. He said, samadhi is simply realizing that your nature, your true nature, and the phenomenal world are meeting right here, now, as your life. Your nature and the phenomenal world are meeting, merging, right here, right now, as your life. You know, this is not being at odds with yourself. You know, this is being being okay with this body and mind, and actually enjoying, and even its many foibles. Being relaxed with its many foibles, many deficiencies, which could be called deficiencies, which could be called foibles. So, you know, those are some definitions of samadhi. And as some of you know, I've been studying for a while, not on my own, because I don't think I would have undertaken this study on my own, but with the help of my teacher, I have been studying the Avatamsaka Sutra for over a year now. The voluminous Avatamsaka Sutra runs to us some, 1,600 pages. And with the help of my teacher, I've managed to get to almost page 400. But one of the motifs, as I've come to learn about this Avatamsaka Sutra, one of the motifs of this sutra is that it is frequently and voluminously extolling the practice and virtues of bodhisattvas, enlightening beings. goes on and on, extolling the practice and virtues of enlightening beings. And one of those virtues and practices that it frequently brings up is the practice of samadhi. Or as Cleary translates it, he says he translates it as concentration. Translates it as concentration. Maybe if I drink a glass of water, I can pronounce words better. I don't know. But I will give you an example. I wrote an example. Among the many that I've encountered that I particularly appreciated of this theme, this motif of extolling the virtues of bodhisattvas. This is, I think, from the chapter called Chief in Goodness, although don't quote me on that. But in any case, this is the section that I wrote down here. Extolling, and this, so that when it's referring to bodhisattvas, their knowledge and wisdom is independent and inconceivable. Their speech in explaining truth is unhindered. Their generosity, self-control, tolerance, energy, meditation, wisdom, skill and means, spiritual powers, and such are all likewise free. By the power of the Buddha's flower garland meditation, they enter samadhi on one atom and accomplish samadhi on all atoms. And yet, that particle doesn't increase. In one are manifest inconceivable lands. What in one atom is manifest is also manifest in all atoms. This is the mystic power of samadhi and liberation of these sages of great renown. If they want to make offerings to all Buddhas, they enter into samadhi and produce mystic transformations. Able to reach throughout the universe with one hand to give offerings to all the enlightened ones. So apparently bodhisattvas are the enlightened ones, and they're reaching out through the entire universe to give a hand to all other enlightened ones. They're reaching out their hand. Yes.
It just occurred to me that the bodhisattvas then operate through quantum entanglement.
Maybe so. If we had some physics majors in here, they might agree that the bodhisattvas operate. They certainly do operate in the Avatamsaka Sutra. They certainly do operate on the cosmic plane. There is no doubt about that. Their mystic transformations are certainly not occurring in the world that we're usually familiar with. That is for certain. So this is the part where it says that entering into samadhi is a mystic transformation. And I would submit that it transforms the bodhisattva who undertakes the practice, and it liberates those who are on the receiving end, if you will, of the practice. It liberates others. And we have this image in this particular section of the bodhisattva reaching out through the universe, extending her hand, I imagine, to all beings. And I think this is a very important point, that by definition, this mystic power of bodhisattva is not accessed by a time-bound or a phenomena-bound consciousness. By definition, a mystic power goes beyond a time-bound, phenomena-bound consciousness. So then if you're beyond the time-bound and consciousness about bound consciousness, well, basically anything is possible. Like you can reach out your hand through the entire universe to benefit beings. And I kind of quoted this at the beginning of the sit tonight, there's another teacher that says to enter samadhi is to enter the circle of wonder. Just enter the circle of wonder, which to me speaks of a kind of transformation, a kind of mystical transformation. And we can be, you know, I feel oftentimes going along sitting meditation, I kind of stumble in to samadhi. I all of a sudden, I think, as Mel Whiteman said in his book, you know, he said something like, I thought, he was sitting and he said, I thought, this is samadhi. And, you know, so you can have that kind of experience. You could be just innocently sitting, you know, practicing your techniques and you know, focusing on your breath and sitting upright and, you know, remembering to keep your eyes open and so forth. And innocently doing all these things, you stumble into the circle of wonder. And then, you know, oh, you realize, I didn't do this by my own power. There is no way I did this by my own power. I just fell in here. I just fell into this circle of wonder. And then you kind of in the circle of wonder. So, wow, look around. Check it out. Pretty cool. And, you know, it might get to a point where you try to hang on to it. But don't worry, you won't be able to. So, finally, I want to bring up the fact that, you know, this is Avatamsaka Sutra is a very old sutra. First, probably early part of the first millennium of the Common Era. You know, they don't know exactly the dates, but or the authorship, probably multiple authors of this sutra, and certainly probably completed by the 4th century, maybe written between the 2nd and 4th century, something like that. But they don't know. We don't have the original Sanskrit, only Chinese translation at this point. So original Sanskrit is lost. But anyway, in any case, this sutra that was written so long ago was kept around in Tang Dynasty China and studied quite a bit and very influential on the Zen school. Very influential on the Zen school, and many stories or phrases from the Avatamsaka Sutra appear in Zen stories. And if you and so I'm going to point out one that's that comes up in that's recorded 1,000 years after the Avatamsaka Sutra was written in the Book of Serenity. So that's the power of this sutra hanging around for that long. So it says, as you might remember, I just said a few moments ago, they enter samadhi, that is the bodhisattvas, on one atom and accomplish samadhi on all atoms. And yet that particle, that one atom, doesn't increase. In one are manifest inconceivable lands. What in one atom manifests is also manifest in all atoms. So that phrase, those little phrases there, stuck in the minds of some Zen ancestor, and some students of Zen ancestors. And so recorded in the Book of Serenity, in a case 99 of the Book of Serenity, a monk asks Yunmin, what is every atom samadhi? What is every atom samadhi? And Yunmin says, rice in the bowl, water in the bucket. So I like this. I love to run across, and I innocently on my own ran across this connection, which was always wonderful when you are doing some study and you innocently run across a connection like this without somebody telling you, you know, oh, go look at a case, you know, 99. I just innocently, and I, oh wow, that is cool. They're bringing up the Avatamsaka Sutra in Yunmin, I don't know, he's probably 8th century or something like that. So quite a bit, you know, after the Avatamsaka Sutra has been around for quite a while. And, you know, as we talked about, as I mentioned, this Avatamsaka Sutra takes a very cosmic, you know, viewpoint, you know. Bodhisattvas can reach their hand across the entire universe. But Yunmin brings it right back down to the ground, right back down to rice in the bowl, water in the bucket. So, you know, in the Avatamsaka Sutra, the flowers are in a garland, you know, an imaginary garland. And I imagine for Yunmin, the flowers are right in there in the garden. They're just right there in the garden. That's the kind of feeling you get with this, you know, rice in the bowl, water in the bucket, or yoki meal, right? So some of you have done or yoki meal. And you can practice samadhi in an or yoki meal. When the server comes with a pot of rice, you put out your bowl and you make sure, you know, to get it just over the rim so they don't spill any rice anywhere else but into your bowl. You're very careful. You bring it back. You bow. You set it down. And then later on in the meal, after you've washed your bowl with the setsu and you have some wastewater, the server comes around with a bucket and you carefully put out your hands and you turn the dish toward yourself and let the water, and the server, the person holding the bucket, kindly angles the bucket toward you so that it makes it easy for you to put your dish water into the bucket. So I think the point I want to leave you with is that your practice of shikantaza, your practice of dhyana, your practice of samadhi, it is all practice on one atom, which is this body and mind. And that practice rolls over joyfully into the world. You can absolutely see this. When you do this practice, deeply do this practice, you will see that this practice can cause you to joyfully roll over into the world on everything, every action, every instance. This is something to keep in mind. It's kind of ideal. You could say that. It's kind of an ideal. But when you're deeply engaged in the practice, you won't think it's an ideal. You'll think this is just the way it is. My practice of one atom samadhi is rolling over into chopping these onions, and carrying this pot and eating this food and so forth. So we aspire to be like that. We're probably not always going to be like that, but as my teacher once said, when we're like that, we feel really good about ourselves. We feel really good. We feel really good. I think he was talking about that when he made that comment. Well, that's enough for me. But when he made that comment, he was talking about how in Sesshin, we don't eat between meals. Just eat enough at the meal, and then wait until the next meal to eat again. And he was saying that when we practice that way, we feel really good. So, thank you very much. If you have any comments or complaints, let me know.
Clem, I was going to say exactly the same thing, because I'm reading this book called The Lotus and the Quantum, or maybe it's The Quantum and the Lotus. And they talk about the fact that at the quantum level, things can be communicated across the entire universe. And in fact, everything in the universe is dependent upon everything else in the universe. So the rice and the water can be absolutely mystical and yet very profoundly ordinary at the same time. So, but anyway, thank you. Appreciate your talk very much.
This is a good day to bring up the quantum ness of this teaching, because today was the release of the first pictures of the Vera Rubin telescope, named for a woman astronomer back in the 50s who theorized. Who was the first one to theorize that there must be something called dark matter in the universe, even though we can't see it at all, and we can't detect it at all with any of our instruments. And so today, speaking of the quantum, was the release of this telescope that was named for Vera Rubin, and it's in Chile, and they released the photographs, and they think in the next 10 years, they will discover 20 billion new galaxies in the universe vis-a-vis this telescope. This is like the Avatamsaka Sutra, this is the kind of language that the Avatamsaka Sutra, the cosmic perspective that it takes, 20 billion galaxies and 20 billion bodhisattvas and so forth and so on. And yet, actually, apparently, this is reality as well. This is really, really what this universe, this amazing universe has to offer. 20 billion galaxies. And that's maybe just the start. That's, we're in one called the Milky Way, right? Take that times 20 billion. Yes?
Thank you for your talk, Jim. I'm reminded that Suzuki Roshi was not in favor of, you know, us flying to the moon. He says, we have enough to deal with right here. Mm-hmm. So there's your rice in the bowl and water in the bucket.
Yeah.
Yes, Jim, I've read the Avatamsaka Sutra. The kaleidoscopic quality of the language in it is really mind-blowing. I can't imagine any single person or any unknown number of people even composing a document like that. And I think 20 billion is actually an underestimate. I read somewhere that the numbers that are talked about within the Avatamsaka Sutra, if you translate it to, you know, decimals, it's like a 10 with 84 zeros after it, which is an unimaginable number. Mm. I would like to put forward that we might consider studying chapters out of the Avatamsaka Sutra for a book study, because it's a fascinating, fascinating piece of work. Thank you.
Well, we studied a few phrases tonight. It's a start. Sean, I think.
Thank you, Jim. I read somewhere that Avatamsaka Sutra is they said if you were going to, we're talking about tankas a lot, but if you were going to give a visual, you know, that's like the most elaborate tanka. If you look at the detail on these tankas, it's just endless, because you go into one petal of one part of the pedestal that the Shakyamuni Buddha is sitting on, and it has so much detail in it, and then that goes with detail, and that is detail. It just keeps going, like a butterfly's wings or... But I don't know if you all are familiar with the film Interstellar. It's one of my favorite films. And here's this line that I think it's Anne Hathaway's character utters, and she's just talking. It seems kind of like random in the dialogue, but she sort of has this realization, or she says that love is the only thing that can just cross the universe immediately. That is not bound by the distances of the universe. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, that just really, and that stayed with me for so long. And then the other thing, this last thing I'll share is just a wonderful story from the life of St. Teresa of Avila, a great Spanish mystic of the 16th century. And she tells a story of one of her elderly nuns in one of her monasteries who was sharing in a sort of a spiritual conference with St. Teresa, that she just didn't think she really, after all these many years, like 70 years in the monastery, was cut out for the life of a contemplative nun. And St. Teresa said, well, tell me, what do you do? What's your practice? And she said, because I just begin to pray, and I get this first two words of the Our Father out, and she goes, and then I just fall into silence. And St. Teresa was just marveling, is that this elderly nun was just literally falling into samadhi, and she's had no realization of it at all. She just, that was her practice, and she was there. She just didn't ascribe it to any kind of achievement or any kind of pat on the back and look what I've gained and look how mystical I am or whatever. She just fell silent after saying two words, the Our Father.
Well, it's we don't often use the words mystical around here, but I was reminded just yesterday that a book that was written about Dogen is titled Dogen Keegan, Mystical Realist, Mystical Realist. So that's an interesting title, and you can't really, I really don't think you can explain everything, and certainly Reverend Mio would agree with me, You can't explain every thing based on materialism. I recommend that we be open to this idea of mystical transformation. Open, I mean, maybe it's not as mystical as we think. It's not as far away as we might suppose.
When you were saying that really in so much of the literature I've encountered, it's the utter ordinariness of the mystics, of what they realize. They don't become less or more human. Oh, they become more human. They don't become something other than human. They become more deeply who they truly are. And that's just very ordinary.
Somebody was talking about their teacher, something we read. Maybe it was Shoto Harada Roshi, I don't know. But they were talking about, you know, he was just such a great teacher, and he just give these great Dharma talks. And then they said, but then he'd just be this little old man walking around the Zen Center. You know? He's looking so ordinary, you know, so plain Joe kind of person.
You know, I would also posit that ritual allows you to enter into samadhi. There's something about with the sangha and bowing together and the silence that comes and then the voices that come from the chanting. They're unembodied in sometimes. I get that feeling as I'm chanting, but I'm also listening. And I'm hearing, and all of a sudden I don't hear myself, I hear the community. And I think that's part of the power of ritual, to put us into that, a state of samadhi.